is similarly not the most commented upon aliyah that you'll find in the whole Chumash, similar to last week. But there is what to discuss. There's always what to discuss if you look hard enough. But there is some significant discussion about the theme of this aliyah. That here, Shlishi, just to look at the aliyah, we'll just talk about it in its totality instead of going pasuk by pasuk. But the aliyah is talking about the tahara process for a mitzvah. And this particular aliyah, Shlishi, focuses on the differentiation between the process for an ani and for an asher. We know that we find that certain times in the Torah. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Sometimes a different standard, if one is unable to afford the whole process that the Torah otherwise indicates. So here the aliyah begins, v'im dalhu. If this mitzvah is, apparently that means that he is poor. But then it seems to repeat itself by saying, v'ein yodo maseges, and therefore he is not able to afford the whole process. V'lakach kebes echad, ashon usnufu l'chaper olav, yisaron solos echad, v'alav v'shem l'mincha v'log l'shemen. So he takes the one kebes, v'shtei sorim, o shnei v'nei yona, asher tosig yodo, v'haye echad chatos, v'echad olav. So instead I'll take two birds, whether it's two torim or two b'nei yona, that which he can't afford. One will be the chatas, one will be the ola. Behavi also biyom hashmin l'taras olakon al pesach olmoi b'fnei Hashem. So he brings that on the eighth day for his tahara process, and then the aliyah continues to tell us about the ashram, which the rest is basically all the same as you find for the asher. So there are a number of points that are commented upon in this aliyah. So again, we'll just talk about it a little bit holistically without going through it pasuk by pasuk. But there are a number of observations that are made by the Mefarshim and by Chazal. The Gemara has a few interesting drushes on these psukim in terms of what's the same and what's different. So the idea that the asham process is the same, and it's only the chatas and the ola that have a different standard between the ani and the asher. So this is something that's commented upon by some of the Mefarshim, Rav Shamshon Ufal Hirsch. And his notes on this aliyah, so he observes that the ashram is the same because in his language the duty of brotherhood and social justice is the same for rich and poor alike. That apparently reflecting upon the fact that the avera here, the lashon hara, the infringement on other people's well-being is equivalent, and therefore he writes that a person's lot is not a factor when he's judged for social sins, and that's what the Ashram Mitzora is there to atone. It says only his language is, not his language, it's the English translation of his German commentary, so as close to his language as we're able to relate to. It says only the tenor of life as a whole varies with the rich and the poor. Different external conditions call for the testing of different aspects of moral strength. So therefore, the Ashram Balok Shem is the same, but the chattas and the ola are different because they represent the sanctification of life in general. It's a little bit esoteric. It's a little bit hard to pin down exactly what he means by that. But there is a comment about this also in the Sefer Aznayim L'Torah, the Litzke Rav, Zalman Saratskin. So he makes the point that there is kind of a dual point being made by the Chumashir. It's a little bit two conflicting points, but that's perhaps the message. That we know that one of the averos for which one contracts saras is gasus ruach, is haughtiness, which is also connected to lashon hara, the more well-known cause. One of the many roots of lashon hara is the idea that one feels superior to others. One feels that it's up to him to lord over and to judge other people. So gasus ruach and lashon hara are related ideas, which are both cited as the cause for tzaras. So therefore we have a dual message here, that as far as the main korban is concerned, he brings the korban just like an asher, says the Adnayim L'Torah, to show that he was meyiz like an asher, that he's haughty just as if he was a rich person. So let him pay the price, let him bring the korban just as a rich person. And in that context, the Torah emphasizes imdalhu. This is one of the issues that both Chazal, as we'll mention in a moment, and Mefarshim are commenting upon, that it seems a little redundant to say both imdalhu and imlo sasig yado. So he can't afford it and he's poor. We don't need both statements. They're both the same thing. So the idea of the repetition, so the Aznayim Torah suggests, that is there to emphasize that, look, here he is, he's dal, and yet he acted begasas ruach, and yet he, nonetheless, despite his daliskeit, he acted with haughtiness, and that's itself worthy of criticism. The Meshech Chachma has a comment about that we'll come back to in a minute. And nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has rachmanis on him, and at the same time, still does give him a pesach for tshuva. Doesn't say all the way, all right, so now because you think you're such hot stuff, so you have to bring the whole package the same way an usher does, we still recognize that despite your haughtiness, you are still lacking something, so we'll still allow for this path to tshuva to be a little bit easier. So that's how he's balancing this language of lo sasig together with dalhu.
Hi. Does that mean it's more inappropriate for poor people to have gassus ruach than wealthy people?
So the Meshech Chachma, we'll come back, Meshech Chachma is commenting on a different phrase, so we'll come back to it in a minute, but he actually makes that point, which you have to figure out exactly what he means, so hold on to that thought, we'll come back to it in a second. He makes it in another phrase within the pasuk. So the Medrash, the Taurus Kohenim, also comments on this double language of dal and lo sasig yado, and suggests what the chiddush is of each phrase. And he writes that the idea of dal is to show that you might think that, or the idea of mosa segedo on top of dal is that you might think that dal means relatively speaking. Like we have by de machzoro, that somebody might be considered poor, not really by objective standards, but that they used to be better off. So you might think, okay, if somebody feels like he's pinched compared to what he used to be, so then maybe that also justifies him bringing a lower style, a lower grade korban. So therefore the Torah says, no, it's not only that he's dal, it's that he literally can't afford this, and lo sasig yado, he can't obtain it. And then if it just said, and lo sasig yado, says the Torah's Kohenim, so then you might have thought that even if you have a usher, but he's simply not able to find the right animals that the Torah asked for, so maybe that's also justification to go to the next level. So no, it's got to be both. Both that he's not able to obtain it, and he's not able to obtain it, not because he simply can't find it, but because he's poor, and not just relatively poor, but poor in the sense that he can't afford this korban, which is interesting. In the Paradis Yosef, he has a lot of discussion about the language dal in general, what it means in this context, and how it means many things. If you look through Chumash, you find it meaning all kinds of chesronos, all kinds of deficiencies. It could mean dal in terms of kavod, it could mean dal in terms of mitzvos, dal in terms of lots of different things. So therefore the Torah has to emphasize that here we're talking about financial chisromis, that you're lacking the wherewithal. But in the context of that, he discusses this point, the question of an usher not being able to bring the ani level karban, even if he has other reasons why he can't obtain the appropriate karban. So it provokes the question, so would a usher be yotze b'dieved with the korban of an ani, or even more so, vice versa? Let's say the ani decides to splurge, and he somehow is able to bring the korban of an usher. Would he be yotze? So as the Paradis Yosef notes, this would seem to depend on a chakira, one could ask, that what's the idea of having two levels of korbanos here? Is the Torah saying that there really are two separate processes, and you have to make sure to get the right one? Or is it that really the Torah asks for that which is understood as the korban ashu? But we have Rachmanis on the ani who's not able to afford it, so therefore we're a makel for him. But if he doesn't want to avail himself of the kula,
meaning what's the lechachil and what's the b'yavet?
Or meaning that the idea that there are these two types, does it represent two actual different models or two different kaparos? Or no, really there's only one. But the fact that the Torah is makel on the ani is a Rachmanis for him. So presumably the root of the question is that maybe you should say, and maybe especially when we talk about this Aveira, which is so rooted in Gassus Ruach and haughtiness and the like, that maybe that's actually the issue, that maybe the whole Kapara process is fundamentally different. And that it's not simply that there is one Kapara and if you can't afford it, we give you a break, but that the Kapara requires a different level of involvement, a different level of participation, and he simply can't accomplish that with the carbon of an ani, even if there are other circumstances. And vice versa, the ani, if he was attempting such a approach, is not going to really connect properly either, that there is a specific kapara that is designated for each social class, that somehow it connects to the avera. So the Meshech Chachma has a few comments here. Meshech Chachma also commenting on the phrase dal, where he notes another interpretation. He says dal could mean lacking anything, so here it could mean also he's lacking a friend. He doesn't have anybody to support him, because the Gemara does tell us, we'll mention in a second, that the carbon for the Mitzorah could theoretically be brought by someone else. You could have a Noder, who's a different person, who could decide to bring the carbon on behalf of the Ani. And therefore, even if he's not able to afford it, doesn't mean that he's necessarily going to be on this level of bringing the lower level carbon. It could be that his friends will come in and they'll take care of it. So the Torah is emphasizing that, however, if A, he can't afford it, and Yodo Masagas, and Dimdalhu, that he's also friendless. He doesn't have anybody who's able to step in and support him, which presumably reaches a higher level of poignancy and a greater focus when we're talking specifically about the Mitzorah, whose Avera is about alienating people, is about causing people to be separated from each other emotionally. So perhaps the Meshech Chachma didn't say this part, but maybe that's particularly relevant to what's going on here, that in the context of this richuk that's been created, so now you have somebody who not only has he created division within society, but he finds it coming back on him that he doesn't have anyone who's going to step in and bail him out, so to speak. So not only can he not afford it, but there's nobody else who's worried. He's saying, wait a minute, this guy needs a kapara. This guy needs to come back into the machna. And the Torah is emphasizing how he finds himself in that situation. Not only is he can't afford it because of his own economic status, but he also doesn't have any friends. This idea of the Noder as a separate party, so it's interesting, the Gemara has, in Maseches Erechin and Daf Yud Zayin, the Gemara has a couple of drushes. You have to look at it carefully so you can see what the difference is, because if you read it too quickly, it looks like it's the same din three times. But there's different details that the Gemara darshans from language in this pasuk, that there are three different circumstances. That if the Mitzorah is an Ani, but the Noder on his behalf is an Ashir, so then he has to bring a cover of an Ashir. That's essentially what the Meshech Chachma is saying, that if he has friends, he's not going to end up bringing this lower level carbon. If the Mitzorah himself happens to be an Ashir, but he has a friend who wants to pay his tab, and the friend is an Ani, so still, he brings the carbon of an Ashir, who doesn't get to say, well, the guy who's paying can't afford it, so therefore, will we make it for him? And if they're both Aniim, if he's an Ani, and still he has another friend who's an Ani, who wants to pick up the tab for him, so then the carbon is an Ani. So the Torah Tumimah says, well, what's the Chiddush there? It's pretty obvious, right? That if we have this level for an Ani, and both the Mitzorah and the person who's paying the bill, they both qualify as an Ani, so it seems pretty obvious that that should be the rule, that you should follow the Korban Ani. So the Torah Tumimah suggests that maybe this idea that there's a special Rachmanis for the Ani, that only applies to the Mitzorah himself, because he doesn't have a choice, he's got to do this. So we'll give him a kula, we'll say that he can take the lower level option. But the person who's doing it on his behalf, who's volunteering, he doesn't have to. So we'll say, listen, if you're going to volunteer, then you got to pay the full bill. It doesn't help that you happen to be an Ani. If you're too Ani to afford it, then you shouldn't volunteer. So that's itself interesting on a couple of levels. Also in terms of the lumdus, what it probably connects to is that question again of if the kapara is specifically tailored towards the Ani, or if it's just rachmanis for the person who can't afford it. And then maybe you'll say that the rachmanis is going to be all based on need, not based on who the person who's getting the kapara actually is. So here the Meshech Chachma makes the comment relevant to what I pushed you off about before, that the language here is different from what it says by the Ashir. That by the Ashir, it says lichaper, and here it says vichaper, as if it's something that has yet to happen. then it sounds like by the Asher, when he finishes this process, that is his kapara. And the language is subtly different here. It sounds like it has yet to happen in the context of the Ani. So the Meshech Chachma says, your question from before, he says that, yes, as funny as it may sound, that it's a bigger Avera for the Ani to be haughty than the Asher. Meaning what? Yeah, he's saying that Asher, so it's natural that he's going to be haughty, that that's a part of the life circumstances, that he's going to be distracted from how he is somewhat arrogant. He's not going to realize that he's acting inappropriately because it's just what comes naturally with his status in life. So therefore, it's wrong, but it's wrong in a more understandable way. So this process brings about a kapara, but somebody who doesn't have a social setting which is pushing him towards arrogance, and yet has enough internally driven arrogance that he's going to feel it anyway, even without any kind of feedback that supports it. So that's an even more troubling issue, and that's what's being suggested here, that the kapara is not yet finished. It's a difficult idea, an idea to say that Nevera is worse for... is worse for a poor person than for a rich person. It's hard to relate to that. I just saw some discussion recently about a law that was struck down in a state that gave a greater penalty to homeless people than to non-homeless people, that if you couldn't provide an address, so the punishment for the crime was worse. And the Supreme Court of that state struck it down and said, how could you punish somebody more for being poor, essentially, for saying they're homeless, that their crimes are considered to be worse? That is a good question. So here, what it seems to be saying is not that the punishment necessarily is worse, but that this midah of arrogance takes on a greater quality to it, takes on a greater egregiousness to it when it's completely self-driven and where you don't have the excuse that everyone's been coddling you, everyone's been giving you the impression that you're occupying a higher social status. Okay, so then if you give in to that, if you get a swollen head, so then it's bad, but it's understandable. But if you're providing your own swollen head, so then we have to worry about it even more, and you need a kapara in order to address that.
Could you say that it's related to the idea that tzaddik is judged harsher for the small things, small sins or something. So a poor person should be more connected to God because he's crying out more, he's praying more, that kind of thing. And
it's an interesting question. You find that, it seems a little bit, excuse me, a little bit more of a Christian kind of idea, that there is the elevation of poverty as specifically being godly, that the idea that being divested of all the human property makes one specifically more spiritual. So it exists in a different way. That I think we mean, like, so for example, you have a chola, a person who's on his deathbed, so the idea that Shekhinah is present, a person who's in a more dire circumstance is connected. Maybe perhaps that's what you're referring to. And certainly the idea of a de-emphasis on Gashmias is certainly very much a Jewish idea, but whether or not that correlates exactly to saying that the Ani is specifically holier, that might be a little more of a jump, but the idea in general that need creates a little bit more of a connection, and that that certainly is an idea that you find in Chazal. So you say that therefore he should be more sensitive. It could be.
Because this is a spiritual crime, perhaps, I mean, it has been a little fair, but the spiritual kapara would take effect for his spiritual crime, which he should be more sensitive to.
Could be. I think what Meshech Chachma is focusing on a different detail, but your point could be true as well. I think he's focusing on the fact that the Asher, so it's somewhat understandable that he'll fall prey to this problem of haughtiness because it's so conducive, his social circumstances are so conducive to it, it's so in sync with that. But if somebody's providing that attitude from his own personality, even though there isn't this constant feedback, if that's the way he should feel, so then that's even greater point of concern. Perhaps the Oznayim Mataru also notes that the constant repetition of Imdalbu, not only that it says that, but that that's a repeated theme here, he says that that also correlates to another component of the issue of Mitzorah, that another reason given for the punishment of Tzaraas is if a person is stingy, if a person is Tzara'ayim. So therefore, we want to make sure that that doesn't persist here, that maybe somebody will say, listen, he's not really so poor, but he's stingy, doesn't want to splurge for mitzvos. So he'll invoke poor status so that he doesn't have to bring the korban asher. So therefore, the Torah is telling us that, listen, you know, on the one hand, we need to have this rachmanas for the legitimate ani, but you should make sure that you really deserve that status. So the Torah keeps emphasizing, just remember that you're bringing this only because you're a dal, and not because you want to give yourself the status where it's not really appropriate. What's also discussed, it's also noted about this aliyah, as we mentioned before, is the fact that then after it mentions the difference, so then it goes into great detail about the part that's the same. So why do we need that to be repeated? Why don't we just have the Torah tell us that the rest is the same and the differentiation that we'll talk about. So that there's nine the Torah comments is that he doesn't want the Ani to feel that he's inferior to the Asher. Okay, so we have this detail which changes, but the rest, his process is the same and he should feel like his kapara is identical. So therefore the Torah doesn't want to say, okay, we're going to skimp on the words for you also. You're only going to get a few letters in the Torah because you can't afford the whole pasuk. So therefore the Torah makes sure to give the same level of attention, to spend the same amount of words addressing the Asher, so that he shouldn't feel like there is anything that's lacking. If you want a more lumdish interpretation of that specifically, of what is the chiddush, in a more lumdish technical sense, the Sefer Chavetzelos HaShar and Nala Torah has a few pages on this, discussing what might be possible, havaminas and chidushim, of why the Torah restates all those dinim in the context of the Ani. The Netziv, in his comment, also notes that the idea of emphasizing Imdalhu is also different from the way it appears in the rest of the Torah, that it talks about it in the present sense, while other korbanos that shift, that you find the Torah talks about it in the future sense. If one will not be able to afford it, then this is the rule, while here it talks about in the present sense if one cannot afford it. So the Netziv suggests that the difference is that the other korbanos one theoretically puts aside and then waits for the three regalim and he brings them up to Yerushalayim and he brings it then. So theoretically, what would happen if one would be mafresh a korban when one is poor, and then later on, when the time comes to actually bring the korban, so thank God he's doing better in business now, and now he's an usher. So let's say at the time when he actually has to bring the korban, he's an usher, so is he allowed to rely on the fact that when he separated the korban to begin with, he was an ani? So the Netziv writes, no, we'd have to bring the korban of an usher then. So therefore, the Torah is using the future tense when it talks about those in order to say that, listen, you have to be aware of the fact, chachamein et barosho, that if the time comes to bring this korban, you're going to be more well off, then you're going to have to bring the full korban. So therefore, the Torah uses the future language that, no, that if at that time you're not going to be able to afford it, then you'll be able to rely on the cheaper korban. But if at that time it's not going to be true, so then you're going to have a problem. So plan ahead and be aware of what to bring then. But in the case of the Mitzorah, so it's more immediate. He needs to get back into the Machaneh. He's not going to be able to get back in unless he does this right now. So all that's going to be relevant, there's no two stages. All that's going to be relevant is whether he can afford it right now. So therefore the Torah talks in present sense that we're going to assess it at this point. Okay, so that's just a few nekudas about this aliyah as a whole. There's a lot to darshan there. There's a lot to see in terms of the type of kapara that's necessary, in terms of the different midos that are being addressed and being accounted for. There really is a lot to think about those ideas that we find in those few brief psukim. And again, like we emphasized last week, it's all the more important, all of these parshiyos in the second half of Shmos and Vayikra. So we keep saying why Man Hazeh, even when we don't have these things, that it's more important to study them. So here, on a whole different level, Tazria and Mitzorah, where we are so aware that we don't have the immediate feedback of having a physical manifestation of our interpersonal averos. So we have to be all the more sensitive, we have to be all the more aware of where these attributes come from and how to try to address them, and to think about the fact that if we did live in a context where we had that type of feedback, you know, things wouldn't escalate as far as they do, and we'd have more harmonious relationships. And in the absence of these otherwise unpleasant manifestations, as unhappy as they are, they really seem to provide a tremendous check on things getting too out of control, and we have to try, b'zman hazeh, to focus on these concepts as much as we can in the absence of actually getting that direct feedback. So with that, I should spend a few minutes on the point about Bishul that we started yesterday just to discuss, and this will help bring us to another point so that, God willing, next week we'll be able to say as much as we can to kind of round out our Bishul unit before Yatid. But we left off yesterday talking about the Ramah and the somewhat in-between position of the Ramah, that the Ramah says regarding soup, that if you have soup that has cooled off, so you are allowed to reheat it only if lo nitzdanin legamri, if it hasn't cooled down completely. In other words, apparently it's not yad seletispo, it's not that hot, but it's still warm, it's still soup, but it's not yad seletispo. So the question is, what's this position based on, right? He would say, mimanavshach, that if ein bishul achar bishul by soup or by liquid, two separate possibilities, so then cook it again, even let it heat up again, even if it has completely cooled down. And if you want to say that yesh bishul achar bishul, so then if it's gone down and it's not yad seletispo, so then presumably there should be an iser to cook it to yad seletispo. So what's the Ramah's position? What exactly is he saying? He's saying something where, you know, for sure, assume he says something that makes sense, but the first step will be, so where is he coming from? Is he coming from the perspective of ein bishul achar bishul, and this is a chumrah for some reason, or is it coming from the position that yesh bishul achar bishul, and this is a kula for some reason? So that's a major issue to determine. You want to comment on that? No. So the Magen Avraham's position, commenting on this, is that the Ramah maintains, like the view of those Rishonim, which we understood where they were coming from, that ein bishul achar bishul does not apply to liquids, and therefore it's really asum min haTorah to reheat soup that has cooled down because it's reverted to normal. Now, of course, as we mentioned earlier, that there are those like the Prima Gadim who think that even if you want to be machmir by water, but that there should be a difference between soup and water, because cold soup is still cold soup. It still has its soup status. It doesn't revert back to nothing, while water is something that reverts back to its completely previous uncooked state. So one could have made a distinction. It doesn't sound like the Magen Avraham accepts this distinction. It is brought in some contemporary Svarim that Rabbi Yashiv did accept this distinction, that maybe reheating soup that was completely cold would only be an Isser Drabanan, and that reheating water could be an Isser Daraisa. Hi.
I mean, granted, like the metal, so yeah, it goes back, and therefore it's sort of when you started the first, the soup sorry, doesn't, the soup has already changed, but say the definition of liquid, like the Prima Gadim initially said, is about heating something, so then it shouldn't matter, it should still be Isser.
You want to say that,
the
fact that soup doesn't revert originally to its complete original state
is irrelevant. It's irrelevant. It's a liquid.
I hear that you say that the definition of cooking never meant changing it. It only meant
heating it by liquid.
It's an interesting point to focus on. Right? That's the whole concept of cooking by soup. So you're really saying that it really is taka different, which is interesting. So the Magen Avraham doesn't seem to accept any distinction between soup and liquids, and Rabbi Yashiv likely does, but here the Magen Avraham doesn't see much of a difference. So treat it like water, if it's really usher to reheat it.
Could you clarify, why is the Ramah not have the in-between position?
That's what we're trying to figure out. Okay. Right, so if we first start to figure it out, we first have to know where is he starting from. So is he starting from Kula or starting from Chumrah? So Magen Avraham is assuming that he's starting from Chumrah, that he's saying that it's also to reheat soup. So then the question is, why is it mutter if it is lukewarm, if it's lower than stanin lagamri. So apparently, there is a status here of something comparable to Michael Ben Drusoy, that until pondering this comment of the Rabbah, you didn't really have that type of a direct parallelism. That when it came to liquids, it's basically one standard, as we were discussing yesterday, that yatsa, lettuce, bo is cooked, and less than that is not cooked. And with food, there were more gradations. And that Michael Ben Yusai is the minimal level that somebody who's on the run from the police will accept. And as we noted a little bit yesterday, but there's still a big difference between that and what a relaxed person will eat. And then there's all kinds of other gradations. But maybe when it comes to soup, you do have a dual structure here. That yes, cooking it in the first place, that's yatsa lettuce bowl. But not in the gamri makes it edible as soup. So then that's still significant. That's still considered mavushal. It's still considered to have its status as long as it's edible. And if it's warm, it's edible. It's not so geschmack, but it's edible as opposed to being cold. So essentially this becomes the Michael Ben Drusoy of soup, going in the other direction, that it doesn't mean that it's uncooked. It's still at this level. And therefore, that's perhaps what the Rambam is saying, that if it was really uncooked, we wouldn't be allowed to reheat it. That would be an issur d'oraisa. Or maybe an issur d'rabbanan, according to Eliyashiv, according to the Magen Avraham, that would be an issur d'oraisa. But as long as it's still somewhat warm, that's the Michael Ben Drusoy of soup. It's still edible, so then it's not called recooked. It's not called uncooked for it to now be called recooked.
It seems difficult to say that cold soup is inedible, doesn't it?
Some of us find gazpacho. There are some soups that are made for that. Right, if a soup is good, fruit soup. Sorry? Like a fruit soup. Right, yeah, well, all of this is not my style so much, but even if those who maintain
that
such soups are soup, right, we'll have to argue the very definition of soup. I wonder if the Ramad ever heard of gazpacho. I have to look into the history of how that developed, or whether he would call that soup in any sense of the word. But still, we're talking about a different substance. The cold chicken soup. Is there anybody in the world who eats cold chicken soup on purpose?
My father.
Yeah? Okay.
Sunday nights, it's too late to eat it up. So
okay. Interesting. That's amazing.
You guys have a microwave?
You have to call into question.
It's too late.
So I have to bring the microwave closer.
Yes? If we want to parallel it to Michael Ben Drusoy, can we send maybe the Bior Halacha? The halacha wants to say that between Michael Ben Drusoy and Moshe Klotzarcho, there's still Nishin D'Araisa. But right. Over here, the Mishnah Berurah seems to endorse the Ramah, saying that it should be not problematic, that we could be Mekel over here. So doesn't that make it, like you would accept
no, because Mishnah Berurah himself has a whole different understanding of this, as we'll get to in a second. So Shitaso, it's not necessarily a problem. But in between, before you get to that, so the Igli Tal says, similar to what you started to say just now, that Egletal says basically he kind of tear from a couple of kulos here. That, as we mentioned yesterday, the Egletal's position is that any cooking in between this Michael Ben Drusoy state and more than that is at best of the Rabbanan, or the Rambam who acknowledges it. So since that itself is the Rabbanan, and it's a machlokas, we've shown him whether Yesh Bishul Acher Bishul by liquids. So, Basir of the two, we can be Makil and say that since it's possible the whole thing could have been heated up anyway. So, that type of post Michael Ben Drusoy cooking, which itself is only a Drabbanan, we won't be Machmir on the two together. And that's how the Egle Tal explains. Then there are a number of Achronim who take the opposite approach and who say that it's quite surprising, but that really the Ramah's attitude is that yesh bishul acher bishul, even by liquids. That they, that's what a number of the Rishonim had maintained. So maybe the Ramah agrees with that also. But that has a chumrah. For that reason, maybe to be choshesh to the view of the other Rishonim, but not meikar hadin. Only as a chumrah, one should not reheat something that is completely cold. But the Eker HaDin, it would be mutter. And this is a position that a number of the Gedolei Achronim adopted, such as the Mishnah Berurah, this is mentioning, and the Chazon Ish, And Rav Moshe Feinstein all took this understanding that this is the case. So the Chazon Ish, for example, argues that otherwise this wouldn't really, if it wasn't a chumrah, it wouldn't really be a din, because it doesn't have a precise halachic definition to say lo nistan legamri. And what exactly does that mean? How do we measure that? We spent some time yesterday talking about how we measure gratz to lettuce bow. So how are we going to measure this in-between status? So the fact that it's a somewhat of a vague standard is the Chazon Ish. That makes sense, because it's not a maker din. It's a chumrah. So okay, so we can tolerate it being a little bit less precise. Rav Moshe Feinstein also reflects this understanding. He writes that if you have coffee, basically have tea, so you want to pour yourself a second cup of tea. So you have a few drops of cold tea in your cup now, and you're going to pour hot tea into the cup. So shouldn't worry that the hot tea in the second cup is going to be mevashel the drops if you haven't totally wiped out the cup. So you're going to be mevashel the few drops that are in the cup. So says Rav Moshe, no, you don't worry about that. Well, why don't we worry about that? Isn't it technically vishal? He says, no, don't worry about it, because the whole thing is a chumra to begin with. That this was cooked before and it cooled down. So to reheat it would really technically be mutter. But as a chumra, so we don't do that unless it's still somewhat warm. So therefore, little droplets, that's not significant. So we don't have to apply the chumra to that. I think it was Aryeh and David.
What if it's just water, droplets of water in the cup, and you want to put in tea, or you want to...
You mean un-previously cooked...
I mean, no, it came out, let's say, you know, people do klishani and whatever, klishanishi for tea, so they have that cup that they put aside that they're going to pour, they use that for the urn, and then they put it into another cup. Mm-hmm. So that cup generally has little droplets of water in it, and you want to know, do I have to dry this out, or should I... So can you... Let's either pour tea into that, or can you use the urn and go directly back into that cup, even though there's water there?
So was the water hot before and now it's cooled off?
It came from the urn and
right, so that would, be the, that would be the same story, right? So the water was cooked.
Unless you say that water and tea, like, it's...
But he's not coming from that perspective, right? He's saying that the position of the Ramah seems to be that by everything in Bishul Acha Bishul, that there is no distinction between solids and liquids. So therefore, water also in Bishul Acha Bishul. So if it was previously cooked water, but just it's cooled down now, so it's not really usur to reheat it. It's just a chumrah. So the water, you're not even going to notice. There's little drops in the bottom of the cup. So that's not included in this chumrah. David?
So Rav Moshe says that mutter lechatchila, even if it cooled down completely to room temperature?
Little drops, you know, little the drops you don't pay attention to. Yeah, the mutter lechatchila is to not worry about the fact that the cup's not 100% dry. But lechatchila reheats stuff, the whole cup, you know, that would be the issue that Rav Moshe is talking about. But the situation of little drops, that he's not so worried about. Okay, so I just wanted to add that. So we have a few more minutes. Maybe we should talk about something Pesach related to get us a little bit into the mood. Any particular topic? Okay.
Yes. I saw on last year's OU pre-Pesach webcast that Rav Shechter said it was a problem if you have a non-Jewish person at your Seder because it's Torah Shabbat Peh, you can teach the Torah. But I saw in Rav Moshe, he has Mefurish that's... Yeah. He said 100% it's mother because you're just not interested in it. Just make sure they don't touch the wine. If it's not Mavosha, it was a long time ago. But he said because it's like Tevi, who just heard Torah, you're not interested in teaching the Torah, they just sort of hear it. So is Rav Shechter explicitly against Rav Moshe there? Is that not a problem?
I didn't remember seeing that. I listened to the webcast, actually.
It might have been from 2 years ago then.
Okay, I didn't remember. He wasn't talking about the issues of Yantif and about...
He said at the Seder having
a non-Jewish
guest.
So he wasn't talking about the issues of having a guest on Yantif. In general, there's a concern that if you have a guest on Yantif, it doesn't apply to Shabbos. But then when it comes to Yantif, there's a concern that because you're allowed to cook on Yantif, so but you're only allowed to cook for the purposes of... Simchas Yantif, for somebody who's mechuyev is Simchas Yantif. So if you have a guest who's not mechuyev is Simchas Yantif, so strictly speaking, you're not allowed to cook. It'll go back to being an Issur D'oraisa. So Chazal will worry, what are you going to do? You're going to have guests who are Jewish or non-Jewish. So your Jewish guest says, listen, I want another steak, put it on the grill. And your non-Jewish guest is going to say, yeah, I'd like one too. And you say, sorry, yeah, it's not kosher. What are you going to say to him? How are you going to explain? You know, that's going to be a little bit of a difficult situation. So Chazal were worried about that in terms of Yatif, which isn't relevant to Shabbos because it's also to cook for everybody. But so that Chorah would have an issue for the Seder as well, which I'll have to discuss whether or not there is anything to talk about, although there are kulas also, depending on the circumstances. That wasn't what he was talking about?
I think that's how the question started. I think he mentioned that as a side point that he thought it was
relevant. Okay, I'm going to clear there is what to talk about in terms of...
Are you worried about running out of food, you shouldn't buy kindly?
No, so it's not about whether you're worried or not. It's that in general, Chazal were concerned that when it comes to Yatif, that how are you going to have a split policy? How are you going to say that when my Jewish friend asks me for a burger, I can throw it on the grill? And for you, I can't. It's not gonna work. So therefore, Chazal said that it's a problem to invite non-Jewish guests for Yantif meals. And Shabbos meal is different. And there are exceptions, but that's theoretically a concern. As far as Talmud Torah, have to see what
he. Even like if it was cooked already, like on Yantif, since the person himself was in the hood.
Yes,
yeah, so
because you could theoretically.
Should it have really been cooked for him?
No, the problem is that maybe you'll cook more. That maybe you'll have a request for more, and it'll be mutter to cook more for Simchas Yatif. But then you'll have that problem. Okay. Yes, sir.
Should we be concerned with cleaning out our sparring and things for comments?
So that's a good question. So it's relevant a little bit to the issue of Chatzi Shir that we spoke about. The question of whether there is a Isser Ba'yirah Ba'yimadze when you have something that is less than a Kazayis. So that, you know, L'chadchila, we certainly try to have households that are as clean of chametz as possible. The problem is that sometimes it's not possible, sometimes it's not possible to remain sane while still taking a very, very thorough approach. So the question is, what is really the case if you have chametz, but the chametz is certainly less than a kazayis, right? Places where it's not shy for you to have a kazayis size of chametz. So parts of the house where at most the chametz that is going to be there is just going to be crumbs. So it's a question where exactly Balira Balimatze fits in over there. So it's two questions. First question is, this is actually relevant to Daf Yomi yesterday. And the first Mishnah in Beitza talks about the machlokes Beitzel and Beishamai, about the shear for chametz, discussion what the shear is talking about. So there is a question in the Rishonim, is there a shear for Balira Balimatze? First of all, that's the first question. And what difference does it make? Because shiurim, as we've said so far, are relevant for onshin, right? That when you talk about eating chametz, so kazayas will incur kares, and less than that won't. So, but it'll still be asur. So you have that room to distinguish. Kazayas gets a onesh, less than kazayas is just asur. What happens with ba'yirah ba'yimatze? So is there an onesh to begin with? So that's itself a discussion. The Rambam paskins that in general there's no onesh because in general it's a lav shein bo maisa. That most people most otherwise from people who would theoretically violate Ba'yirah Ba'yimatzeh, again, assuming the person is otherwise observant to halachas, so then generally the way they would do it is because they neglected to get rid of their chametz before Pesach. So therefore, it's only a passive maintaining of the chametz in the house, so that's a lav shein bo maisa, so it's not subject to malchus. However, the Rambam does say that if you did bake chametz on Pesach, or go to the store and buy chametz on Pesach, which again, if a person is otherwise observant, it's not so likely that that's what they're going to be doing, but if we come about that way, so then it would be a lot of sheish b'maisa, and when we get malchus. Reb Chaim has a discussion here, the other Rishonim raised the question of why don't we say, forget about lav shein b'maisa, let's say it's a lav hanitak la'asei, because you have an asei of tashbisu, and you have a los asei of bayiran bayimatze, and you have a positive mitzvah to get rid of the chametz in the house.
But not everyone agrees that's a
deraisa.
It might be
a deraisa,
and it might not even be. I thought the Mechas Chinuch gives like gradations of what it might be.
Well, the question that the Mechas Chinuch talks about, and the Reb Chaim talks, they talk about it differently. But the issue that they talk about is to what extent the two correspond to each other. And do you say that Teshbisu is a way of fixing Bali Rab, Bali Matze? Or do you say, no, it's two separate din, that there's an active mitzvah in the Torah of Teshbisu, and then there's also a prohibition to have Chametz and Pesach, and they're not connected to each other. So that was what Reb Chaim discussed in this context, that do you say that it is a lav hanitak lase? But in any event, so it's not clear if there's any onesh for Bali Rab, Bali Matze. So if there's no onesh, so then what's the relevance of the shiur?
Sin.
If there is a shear, sorry?
To not have a sin on your
Right. But so then it means normally with every other aveir, the relevance is to be usher without the onish. But if there's no onish in the first place, if there is a shear, if there's a shear of kizayis, which theoretically could make sense because if the purpose of Bayer Bayi Matzah, like the Ran understands, is not that there's something so terrible about only chametz, but that the Torah doesn't want you to eat chametz. So therefore, in order to keep you from eating chametz, so the Torah says, don't own chametz. So it makes sense to say that the iser correlates to that which would incur a chi of karis. So then it makes sense to say it's a kizayis. So then the question is, so is there an iser chati shir? So then is there anything wrong with having less than a kizayis of chametz? So that's the question. I mentioned the Chacham Tzvi who talked about this, right? And the Chacham Tzvi maintains, for at least two reasons, that specifically talking about Bayura Bayimatzeh, that there's no Nisimatzeh Shira. One reason is because it's only by Yisuri Achila, we discussed that at some length, whether that was true or not. And the other reason he had is a different understanding of what the issue of Chatzi Shir is, that normally a Shir required for punishment. Because without a shear, it's not chashuv, it's not significant. The Torah is saying anything that's too small is not significant. But if you make a whole plan out of eating it, we said we were giving our examples of the Hershey Kiss made out of pork. It's got a whole wrapping and a little string coming out of it and a label. And it's all fancy thing. So it's less than a kezias, but you're bothering to eat it. So then you have bestowed chashuvus upon it from your own perspective. We call Akshavet, that you've decided this is important. But here, like we said before, when it comes to chametz, so in general, the violation of Bayi Rab, Bayi Matzeh will be passive. It's simply that you neglected to get rid of it. So if you neglected to get rid of it, you didn't show it any chashivas. The opposite, you ignored it. You didn't pay any attention to it. So therefore, there isn't anything giving importance to this less than a kezias of chametz. So therefore, it's not going to be prohibited. So, strictly speaking, what is that going to mean practically? So, chatila, no one's going to recommend that if you know that you have crumbs of chametz around that you should maintain them, but certainly chatila want to try to get rid of the chametz that we have. But, to what extent is there an achrayas if you don't have it, if you don't get rid of it, so it's possible that there isn't any isra bayura bayimatsah. So, the question in general is because chametz is machlokas rishonim, why we have bedikas chametz in the first place? Rashi and Tosfos in the beginning of Pesachim, whether you have bedikas chametz so that you shouldn't violate bayura bayimatzeh. So then you could make an argument that you don't have a possibility of violating bayura bayimatzeh if the type of chametz you'd be looking for is so small. The other opinion in Rishonim is that it's so that you shouldn't come to eat it. And maybe you'll find some significant chametz that's going to be tempting and you're going to decide you're going to want to eat it. So then it's also arguable that if we're talking on the crumb level, that we're not really risking any wuska yafifia if it's discussed, that's going to tempt you to eat it. So, however, there is a case to be made that one does not have to factor in chametz that's at such a small level, if you know, in between the pages, how big could it possibly be? So that's probably not going to necessarily be right in, be an issue. However, if you're talking about haggadahs, they're like something that you bring to the table, so then you have an additional concern. But if it's a possibility that you're going to open up your haggadah and the crumb's going to fall out and it's going to land in your soup, so then you're going to have a bigger problem because chametz on Pesach is not bottle with any amount. So that's a separate concern outside of the concern of Bayi Rab, Bayi Matzeh, that you may actually have chametz, land and soup that you're going to be consuming, land and food that you're going to be consuming. So then that's a whole different level. So sparim that are going to be brought to the table on Pesach has a different level of kveida. They say that the Chazon Ish had a practice that before Pesach he would put away all of the sparim, and he would just take out one sefer and he would clean through that, look through that sefer very carefully to make sure there isn't anything in the sefer, and then he would only read that sefer all of Pesach. He would only be involved with that sefer. So say that one year they told the Shabbin Rav, the Beirish, the Shabbos David Misharim, that when the news got and that, oh, you should know, you should be flattered that the Chazon Ish has selected your sefer for his Pesach sefer, and that he prepared that sefer, make sure it was chametz free, and that was the sefer that he was going to use over the course of Pesach. So the Shabbiner's reaction was, that just goes to show you, he doesn't read it the rest of the year. So the rest of the year, this was the easy sefer to clean. He didn't have a concern that it would be too dirty, so only had 1 week a year to read it. Okay, it wasn't too flattered. So that connects to our part to the question of even some people, when you have a reason to be haughty, when you have a social support, that you should feel guided, so you still didn't want to let that get into effect.
It's cool, it's the honor.
There is an interesting lumdus that there is a concept, which was also that only a few weeks ago, called Ketute Nechta Shure, that if you have something that is halakhically on death row, let's say you have a item that has to be destroyed halakhically, so normally you can't use it to fulfill mitzvahs, like you can't use it as a lulav, for example. And the rule is, any din that requires a shear, it has a certain minimum measurement of how big it has to be, so then if it's supposed to be destroyed halachically, so then it's not considered to be the shear, no matter how big it actually is physically, but halachically we don't acknowledge the shear because it's waiting to be destroyed. Doesn't matter how big it is, that's considered to not have the shear. Ketute nif the shear, and we grind up the whole shear and consider it like it's nothing. So there was a discussion some of the Achronim had, the truth about this and the truth is Maharam Brisk, that says, so why don't we say that it's impossible to violate by Yerov, by Yimatze, on Pesach? Because if there is indeed a shear, then you have to have a kezias, but the problem is, there's also a chiyuv teshbisus, right, that the chametz has to be destroyed. So therefore, all chametz, we should say, that it never adds up, and therefore it's impossible to violate the issue, the issur of by Yimatze on Pesach. I mentioned this question once to Rishat, but he didn't think it was. After, even if it's broken up, it's still Perum, it's still, okay, whatever. He wasn't so bothered by this question, but it's just interesting. So what the Maharam Brisk says, he quotes, I believe, the Maharam Mintz, that Maharam Mintz says a big chiddush la'halacha. He says that the concept of ketute mechta shiure, so we would have thought, I think the common understanding is, that it's a halachic stance that, so I guess it could be a little bit related to what we talked about yesterday about halachic status versus mitzvah status in terms of Rambam and Rashba. So here too, you would have thought that it's a halachic status, that something that is designated for destruction is lacking in chashivas, regardless. It doesn't have the shear because it has the halacha of waiting for destruction. But the Maharamin said differently. The Maharamin said that it only has that status if one actually plans on destroying it. The fact that it's imminently going to be destroyed, that means it's not chashiv. But let's say if one wants to ignore the halacha and one decides that he's not going to destroy it, even if the halacha requires it, he's not going to do it, doesn't plan on destroying it. So then, you don't have the status of ketude mechta shiri. It doesn't come from its halach reality, it comes from its actual planned future, and that's going to dictate it. So, therefore, it says the Maharam Brisk, a fascinating idea. He says, so taka, if you plan on destroying your chametz, so you won't be in violation of Bayi, you might say, even on Pesach, because that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that if somebody finds chametz, let's say on Yontif, let's say there's no way to destroy it on Yontif, we talked about that the other day, whether or not there are ways to destroy chametz on Shabbos and Yontif. Let's say you find chametz in your house on Shabbos and Yontif, so the Gemara says you cover it up and you wait till Chol HaMoed to destroy it. So that you're being a violation by your Rav Ahimatze until you do. So the answer is no, that Hamasha Chametz Amanas Levaro, if somebody allows Chametz to maintain in his house so that he's waiting, while he's waiting to destroy it, so he's not in violation of Bayura Bayimatsu. So it says, man in brisk, it says that's why. Because if you plan on destroying it, Taka, the question is right. If you're not the shiure, and you're lacking the shiur, it's always going to be considered less than a kedai. So it's only somebody who doesn't plan on destroying it, somebody says, no, I want to keep this chametz till after Pesach, I need it then. So then that individual, because he's not destroying it, so it's not ketutim if the shiure, and it has the shiur, and then you have a problem.
So to put that halacha, if you can consider some funny situation, let's say you have a non-religious friend and you realize on Pesach he has chametz. Mm-hmm. So you tell him, I'll buy that for you for $50, and you'll keep it mine as soon as you buy it, you'll just burn it right away. So you save both yourselves from Yisurim. Would that be true, or?
A question of whether it's mutter to buy it in the first place, mutter to buy it.
Because that's the whole shita, because you're buying it knowing that you're going
to
destroy
it. Buying it to destroy it.
That's
a fascinating idea, you know, that when it's actually mutter in general. It's interesting, there's a raya from Dikas Chametz that maybe you could. I mean, it's not something I would be too comfortable doing, you know, to buy Chametz on Pesach seems very dangerous. But theoretically, you could make a case that it should be mutter based on the following, which actually comes from Chametz. So, in general, this also relates to what we've been talking about this week in a few ways. So we talked about Bishul Basul Chalav, right? So I think we mentioned the position of the Rambam, that both where the Kesef Mishnah is in one place, and where the Rambam himself stands in another place, is that Bishul Basul Chalav sounds like a Siag Daraisa. It sounds like, even though it's a Din Daraisa, but it's a safeguard that we shouldn't come to eat Chametz. So based on that, shouldn't come to eat Basul Chalav. So based on that premise, there was a question that the Tshuvin Rav, we mentioned a few minutes ago, has a tshuva about. And also Rav Shechter wrote in Beis Yitzchak once, that reminded me, maybe printed one of the latest farms as well, that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik had the same attitude to the same shaila he was asked, that there was a laboratory that devised a test to figure out whether something was basa b'chalav or not. They had a way of testing the food. But the test itself was an act of bishul. So the question is it mutter to do this test, this act of bishul? Maybe it'll be a problem with bishul basa b'chal. So they both paskin, both Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and the Shibin Rav, that since bishul basa b'chal, even though it's asur min ha-Torah, but it's asur because of the concern you'll come to eat it. So here, the whole reason you want to do this test is so that you can come to protect yourself from eating it. So therefore, they passing it was mutter. Mutter to do this bishul, the bishul, the shame not eating it, rather than bishul, the shame eating it.
They passing by the tam.
That itself is a fascinating question, and it'd be very understandable if you wanted to say in darshan time to the kra. But and it's interesting that there's extensive literature about different pratim and possible siag daraisas. As far as I'm aware, the only one who raised the issue of ain darshan time to the kra and that it shouldn't matter is actually a different tshuva, which was written by the brother of the Tshuvin Rav. The Tshuvin Rav, his brother, is the Chazon Nochem of Nochem Wiedenfeld. He has a tshuva where he says, who cares, Tasiak, Tasiak, ain't darshan time to dekra. But for some reason, all the Gedolei Achronim in other contexts, otherwise, did feel comfortable incorporating the siag component into their dinim. It's a much longer discussion, but it's interesting. So in any event, so the Tshuvin Rav said that since you're doing it to keep yourself from eating it, that's what makes it mutter. So he proves this from a din, the Gemara Masechta and Dafir Aleph, about Bedikas Chametz. The question comes up that maybe we should say Bedikas Chametz is a bad idea because we want to stay away from Chametz. We don't want to look for Chametz. So the Gemara says, Hu atmo machzer olav l'sorfo, that your whole mission here is a search and destroy mission, and you're looking for it in order to get rid of it, so then we're not concerned that it's going to lead to you to eat it. That if you're here on this mission that's there for the purpose of destroying it, so then we don't have to be concerned. So you could say, then, a similar svar you could say here as well, that Bal Yira, Bal Yimatze itself, the Ran says, possibly, in the first half from Sachem, that the reason, even though Bayira Bayimatse is also an Issur Daraisa, but the reason for the Issur Daraisa is you shouldn't come to eat Chametz on Pesach. And if that's true, so if you want to follow the same logic of the Chavin Rav by Mishal Basa B'chalav, maybe you can make the case to say that if your purpose in acquiring the chametz is so you can destroy it, especially since his raya was from a chametz raya to begin with, so then maybe you can make such a case. However, to further complicate things, but to further synergize, so it's worth complicating things if it brings about more synergy, that this really seems to be a question of chatei kedeisha izake, right? That your friend is the one with the chametz. So even if you want to make the case that you should be allowed to do this by yirah v'yimatzeh in the interest of tashbisu, in the interest of getting rid of the chametz, the question is, are you allowed to do it on behalf of your friend's tashbisu? That even if he could use all these svaras so far to make a case that it's all right for yourself, but to save your friends from the Bayira Bayimatsay is itself its own question.
But according to the analysis we just said, there's no chay, there's no chatak kadesh.
Correct. You know, you're saying that it depends how you understand. You're saying that the whole Isra Bayira becomes defined by the Tam, and then, right, so that's true. That what I would then say, though, is that as much as there's a certain svara to it, I think it would be hesitant to rely on this, but, you know, would view it somehow as at least a quasi-chait. So the question of can the quasi-chait be justified for the issue of saving somebody else, it's a fair question. Okay, so that's Hashem. We'll continue on Monday with more official things. And now we will...